This is going to be a series on relativism. I'll give you a little introduction tonight, and we're going to talk about the multis. I think for many people, the word relativism is code for now I can do whatever I want. There are no standards, nothing's right or wrong, nothing's true or false, nothing's valid. Since it's all relative, I can do what I want. I want to point out, just as a kind of introduction, that understanding of relativism is itself a mistake. Let me give you a couple of examples. On which side of the road is it correct to drive? Spoken like a true American. Yeah, the right side. Of course, he thinks of right meaning correct. All right. See, all his white hairs qualify, you know, things like that. Now, you say, oh, but that's relative. There is no really correct side on which to drive. It's relative. Okay, fine. Now suppose I ask, on which side of the road is correct to drive in England? All of a sudden, you get a definite answer. The answer is the left side. That is the correct side in England. Period. It's not a matter of opinion. It's not a matter of what you feel or what you think or your subjectivity or how your dreams go or whether you took LSD. The left side is the correct side, period. In the United States, the correct side is the right side, period. In other words, when you say something's relative, all you have to do is fill in what it's relative to. The minute you fill in what it's relative to, then the question of doing what you like disappears. It becomes absolute, objective fact. Relative only tells you that before you fill in what it's relative to, you're in trouble. Then you're not saying anything that's factual. But the minute you fill in what it's relative to, the game is up. Here's an even simpler example. Taller. John is taller. Period. So you say, come on, you didn't say anything. Why not? Because taller is a comparative. It's going to be taller than someone or something. Can't just be taller. Correct. Taller is relative. But the minute I say John is taller than Peter, once I fill in what it's relative to, the game is up. Either he is or he isn't. And that's a matter of objective fact. So, what we see so far is, when you say something's relative, all you're inviting is, tell me what it's relative to, and then all of a sudden things become objective fact. Now, in taller, we can go a step further. That was step one. Here's step two. Conceivably, to get taller straight, to keep track of all the facts, you just make a list of all pairs, let's say for people. All pairs of people, and tell me who's taller than who. I have this gigantic list. I know there are 6 billion people, so the list is going to have 6 billion squared entries, you know, and you'll, I see there's some, actually 6 billion, it's the sum of 6 billion down. It's not factor, it's not squared. It's a gigantic number. There's a much easier way. Give each person a height, a number. All you need is one fact per person, his height. From that, whenever a question comes up, who's taller than who, just compare the numbers. So now, the number becomes an individual objective fact, which lies behind all the comparisons. From the number, all the comparisons can come out. Even if you have all the comparisons, you don't get the number. You can work on that as a homework problem. So, when you're moving towards objectivity, there are two steps. If you have something that's relative, first fill in what it's relative to. And then, in some cases, you're able to take a further step and replace all the relative statements, which are now objective and factual, place them all with a single characteristic of each thing, and from them, all the comparisons fall out, and you've reached a very high level of objectivity and convenience and efficiency. So saying that things are relative is not a way of just saying that it's all up for personal grabs. Einstein created the theory of relativity. What he noticed, what he discovered, or what he was dealing with in a certain way, was that motion is relative. Am I moving right now? Moving? Well, with respect to the table, no. With respect to the earth, no. With respect to the sun, yes. So moving is relative. You can't just say whether you're moving or not. Moving with respect to what? But again, the minute you fill in with respect to what, the answers become definite. With respect to the table, the answer is definitely no. With respect to the sun, the answer is definitely yes. Motion is relative. Turns out that time is relative and space is relative. My time, if you and I are moving with respect to one another, my time and your time may not be the same. Our ways of measuring space may not be the same. Of course, we can always get around this by stating who is relative to. We can talk about time relative to me and time relative to you, and then it becomes objective, absolute. Einstein wanted to take the third step, or the second step, like with height, finding a number which will be the same for everybody. Everybody can agree that George is 6'2". So he wanted to find something in the area of space, time, and motion that would be equal for everybody. So you wouldn't have to fill in what it's relative to. You could figure out the relatives, but it'll be absolute. Absolutely, absolutely. Without any, you know, the same for everybody. That's space time. What Einstein did in the theory of relativity is to find the absolute that's not relative to anything. That's the whole point of the theory. The point of the theory is not to say, give up, you know, we live in a multicultural world and everything depends upon how you look at it. On the contrary, because motion is relative, because space is relative, because time is relative, he looked for something that isn't relative at all. And that was space time. Distances and motion and space-time are measured the same by everybody. Everybody gets exactly the same numbers. That's its purpose. Okay, so I hope that we can just not be hypnotized by the word relativity and go into a false picture that, of course, things are relative. That means the sky's the limit, and nothing's valid, and everything is how you feel about it. Now, let's talk about multiculturalism. Multiculturalism. Gosh, what is that? Well, some people put it like this. They have an idea and they have a reason. Here's a first pass to explain it. The idea is all cultures are equally valid. They have equal value, equal significance. No culture is superior to any other culture in any respect. All cultures are absolutely on a par. That's the principle. Why? Why should I think that? Why should I accept that? Other than the fact that it's politically chic. And the answer will be like this. Every judgment of validity or value or significance is made from within a culture. When you talk about what's valid, when you talk about what's important, when you talk about what's valuable, your standards of what is valuable or valid or important or significant reflect your culture. They're how your culture looks at the world. The things that your culture finds important, the things that your culture finds significant, the things that your culture focuses on. And that means that when you try to make a judgment, this culture is more important than that culture, more valid than that culture, more valuable. What you're really doing is you're using your culture's concepts of what's valuable and important and significant and meaningful to apply to another culture. That's apples and oranges. That's apples and oranges. How can you use your standards of what's important and significant and meaningful and valuable to apply to another culture which will have its own standards of what's meaningful and important and significant and valuable? So it's really apples and oranges. It's like applying the rules of chess to a checkers game. It doesn't apply. So, judgments of what is more important or less important, more valuable or less valuable, reflect the attitude of your culture, and therefore they can't apply to another culture. You know, it follows that I can never say that culture A is more important or less important than culture B, because at least one of them isn't mine. Mine might be A, or it might be two of them outside of me, and I'm just exporting my standards of right and wrong, good and evil, importance, value to other cultures, and that can't be done. That's why all cultures should be regarded as equally important, equally valuable, equally significant, equal validity. Huh? Okay? Roughly clear? Now this is crashingly stupid! The way I have put it is crashingly stupid, because it contradicts itself. Why? Now listen again. Listen again. Pretend to sugya, for those of you who have black yarmulkes on. Pay attention and see what's wrong with this. So the way I put it, the words I have used, make it crashingly stupid. Listen again. The proposition is that all cultures are equally valid, equally valuable, equally important, equally significant. Why? Why are they equal? They're equal because whenever we make a judgment about what's valuable and important and significant and valid, we're using the concepts within our culture, the standards within our culture. We're only reflecting the point of view of our culture. And if I'm going to use my standards to apply to another culture, they don't apply. It's apples and oranges. Why should my standards of what's important and valuable and significant and valid apply to another culture, which will have different concepts of what is important, significant, and valuable and valid? And therefore, trying to make a judgment, sitting where I am, in my culture, about another culture, is apples and oranges. It's like applying the rules of chess to a checkers game. Now, it's just a contradiction here. Just a simple, straightforward contradiction.
So use your own standards. Just say it like...
No. I don't want a rebuttal. I want to show a contradiction in their position.
And you can't say anything about any of them, so don't say they're all equal.
Right. Saying that they're equal is a mistake, because saying that they're equal is a judgment of validity and value and importance and significance. It's saying I'm measuring culture A against culture B, and I find them to be equal. That's a positive judgment of each. If your standards don't apply, then they don't apply to say they're equal either. They just don't apply, period. So the position ought to be, we can't say whether they're valid, equally valid or unequally valid. We can't say more, we can't say less, we can't say anything, not even that they're equal. Because the concepts don't apply. And you can't say, if you apply the chess rules to a checkers game, you can't say it's a good game, you can't say it's a bad game, and you can't say it's an equal game. You can't say anything about it. It's the wrong rules. So if the analogy is supposed to be applying chess rules to checkers, there's nothing you can say at all, not even that they're equal. So the more coherent position, the position that doesn't contradict itself on the face of it at the outset, will be, because the standards of what's important, valuable, valid, and significant are internal to a culture, and because then to make judgments comparing cultures means to export your standards to another culture, and because that can't possibly apply, therefore we can't say anything about the relative value of cultures. We can't talk about comparing them at all. Which isn't the way it's normally put, but this little refinement, you know, I suppose if they're rational about it, they would accept it and say, yeah, I guess that's what we should mean. We should mean that nothing can be said about the relative value or importance of cultures. Okay, that's just a matter of formulation. Now, I have a suggestion of methods. Whenever you're discussing a philosophical issue, and you get those delicious, dizzying, ethereal concepts, justice and validity and responsibility and love and value, which everybody loves to talk about and nobody understands, here's what I suggest. Take it down to simple, easy, everyday common examples and see how it applies. Try it out. Often you discover that you can't figure out how it applies, which means you discover that you really don't know what you're talking about. And often you discover that it applies in ways that are very strange, very surprising. And then you discover, worse than that, that you didn't know what you're talking about, but you really should mean something other than you think you should mean. So I want to try this out. The concepts of one culture, the standards, the values, the importance, the significance, the meaning, all the rest, are internal to the culture. They're created by this culture, and they can't apply to another culture as apples and oranges. Okay. Here's some simple examples. Now you tell me if you agree with the examples. I'm visiting the South Sea Islands. In the South Sea Islands, when they build a house, they do it cooperatively. First they put up the walls, and then they pave the floor. Now there are paving stones that they keep in a quarry. And what they do is, they send people down to the quarry. And each person comes up with a stone in each hand, and they're pretty, you know, fair size slabs of stone. And they make a pile. And they start paving the floor. If they don't have enough stones, they send them back for more stones. If they have too many stones, they take the extra stones back. That's how they do it. All the stones are the same size. So I'm watching this, and I say to them, you know what? I'm going to show you something terrific. I'm going to save you a lot of labor. Watch. So what I do, I measure the two walls, and I multiply, and I tell them, bring up exactly 22 stones. No, they don't have 22. I pick out 11 guys. And I say, you guys go down to the quarry and bring up stones. They all come up, one in each hand, and lo and behold, it's the exact right number of stones. Wow, that's magic. How do you do that? Well, of course, I know how to multiply. See, very simple. I know the rule of finding area. I know the area of the stones. So I do it multiplying, right? Now, could this happen? Am I making some mistake in describing this scenario? Am I contradicting myself somewhere? But look, boys and girls, geometry was invented in Greece. In Greece, in the West. This is out of the island. They don't have geometry there. So what are we doing? We're exporting our concepts, exporting our rules, exporting our standards to the South Sea Island. How can it work? But, you know, works fine, doesn't it? Without any difficulty at all. Even though it's a Western product, the conceptual structure, the rules, the arguments, the validity, is all a Western product, but you know, somehow it works there without any problem. Okay, let's try another one. I'm traveling in the South Sea Islands, and I see a person clutching his abdomen, doubled over in pain. And I touch it. It's very, very sore, very sensitive. So I take out my portable x-ray machine, without which I never travel. And I x-ray him, and I see that he's got a burst appendix. And I take out my anesthesia, without which I never travel. And my surgery tools, and I, open him up, and I take out his first appendix, and I sew him up, and give him antibiotics, everything else, and, you know. Could this happen? Can this happen? Is this conceivable to happen? But look, the x-ray machine was made in Milwaukee. And I learned surgery in Oxford. And the antibiotics were manufactured in France. It's all a Western product. The expertise, the training, the materials, the theory behind it, how x-rays work. It's all Western practice. Obviously, he doesn't know anything about that. This is a whole Western conceptual structure. And we're exporting it to the South Seas, and we're applying it in the South Seas. How could that be? But it's not a mystery, is it? It seems to work very easily, without any difficulty. Now let's take division of labor. You have a society, which was very common until 200 years ago, and in some places probably still exists, where each person does roughly everything for himself. He builds his own house, he weaves his own clothes, he grows his own food, makes his own weapons. Each person produces all of his own basic necessities by himself. These people are dying of starvation, and they're having a difficult time fighting their enemies. They're dying of starvation, even though there are fish in the sea, and there's land to be cultivated. So I come to them and say, gentlemen, and ladies, to be fair, I want you to know you're wasting a lot of effort. If you would specialize and divide the labor, you could be gigantically more productive. You guys train to be fishermen, and you guys train to make clothes, and you guys train to plant the ground, and you guys train to build houses. And you'll find that you can produce a great deal more and have a lot of time left over to explore other possibilities of industry. You'll live longer, you'll do better in fighting your enemies, and you'll live happier, you know, more satisfied lives. But look, division of labor was invented over here in the West. Is it possible to export it to the South Sea Islands? It's a Western concept with Western rules and Western application. How could it possibly apply there? Now, it's true in this case. Maybe their psychology won't accept it. Maybe. I mean, that's conceivable anyway. But it isn't very realistic because division of labor has been exported all over the globe. And it's doing very well, thank you. And the places that don't have it are dying to get it because they can see they can't compete with anybody else who has it. So again, you have a Western concept, a Western practice, which is being exported to other cultures, and there doesn't seem to be any difficulty. We might mention opposite exports as well. What about meditation? Meditation was developed in the East, in India, farther east. Techniques which grew out of their culture, their attitudes and their perceptions and their way of dealing with the world and themselves, their self-perception, all the rest of it, right? Could you imagine that someone from hypertension, who has hypertension in Manhattan, could benefit from meditation? How could that be? It was developed in India. This guy's living in Manhattan. How can you export an Indian concept to Manhattan? But it does very well, actually. Certainly helps certain people. Destroys the minds of other people. I mean, it definitely has an effect. You know, their goal is to destroy your mind. So that means they're really their goal, even in the West. Right? There doesn't seem to be any difficulty in importing this idea and applying it, even in a different cultural setting. And so it is with agriculture and environmentalism. Let's take basic matters of logic. We're gambling. It's only fantasy, right? Okay, we're gambling. I have a coin. I'm flipping it. And we're putting down even money. I'm betting heads, you're betting tails. Now, I get five heads in a row. Let's do it the other way. No, somebody else is flipping the coin and just betting on it. You can bet either way you want. So the coin gets five heads in a row. What are you going to bet on for the next flip? Okay. A lot of people will tell you you should bet on tails. Because look how many heads you got in a row. It's time for a tails. You know, tails is coming up. It's supposed to be roughly even. It used up five heads already. So obviously, you're going to have some tails in the near future and sometime to balance it out. That's called the gambler's fallacy. Why is it a fallacy? Because either this coin is really fair. If the coin is really fair, then it's 50-50 every time. 50-50 every time can get you five heads in a row. Those things can happen when it's 50-50. It's only probability. Or maybe it's not a fair coin. But if it's not a fair coin, then it's biased in favor of heads. Got five heads in a row, right? So then heads is surely the right bet. Tails is never the right bet. I mean, not many better than heads, for sure. Yet, many, many people are convinced that that's how casinos stay in business, because these kinds of people come in and they bet on the one that hasn't come up for a while and they lose their shirts, right? Now let's imagine a whole society of people who commit the gambler's fallacy. You know? When it comes up a few times on one side, they bet on the other side. Does the fact that a whole society is doing it make it right? This is a mathematical mistake. We can prove it's a mathematical mistake. But now you've got a whole society, so then it's society against society. After all, this mathematics is invented in the West. They don't have that mathematics. They don't agree with that mathematics. They think of things differently. Does that mean it isn't a mistake? Surely not. And we can prove it because when we gamble with them, we win. So, you know, something's got to be wrong over there. So this applies to standards of logic as well. Now let's go to a slightly more controversial area. How about truth, or what's logical, or what's reasonable, or what's rational? Can we really use our standards of rationality and truth and logic to apply to a different culture? Isn't that apples and oranges? Isn't that vicious exploitation, you know, intellectual exploitation, lack of respect, and so forth and so on. Let me make an obvious remark. The tragedy is that the discussion is so confused and so politicized that the obvious is missed. What am I supposed to worry about? That they will have different standards of reason from mine. Different standards of reason that will disagree with mine. Different way of thinking of truth and different way of applying truth from mine. Listen, truth is an English word. It's an English word and it's an English concept. We own it. We created it. We patented it and we own it. If somebody else has different standards, then it isn't truth. They don't have to buy our product. But since it's our product, we define it, we created it, and we use it. The very idea that another culture will have really, importantly, different standards of truth, different concepts, different application of truth, or rationality, is a simple, it's the simplest absurdity. R-A-T-R-A-E-A-S-O-N, reason, rationality, are English words. They're English words, English concepts, and we own them. If what they have is really different from what we have, then it isn't reason. It isn't rationality. It's something else. Now, you could raise a general discussion. Maybe what they have is better than what we have. Maybe so. But it isn't competing standards of reason that we have to worry about when we apply our standards of reason. So, you take out the Upanishads, or the I Ching, or some other work that's deeply embedded in a completely foreign culture. Now, their language says that every third Monday of the month it rains. But it doesn't. Well, that statement is false. Oh no, you're taking it out of context. You're exporting your concept of false to their culture. You know, they mean something else by all these things. So what? I don't care what they mean. I don't care what they mean. Because I'm making my statement in my language with my concepts about their book. I'm not trying to explain what they mean. I'm saying what I mean. And the statement is false. It doesn't rain every third Monday of a month. Now maybe they don't care about true and false. Okay, that could be. But that doesn't mean it isn't really false. It is really false. It's really false and they don't care. Bakasha. Just like in our context in Shakespeare, if you take the statements as being about the actual history of the world, they're almost all false. So, nobody cares. Right? But that doesn't mean they're not false. They're false. Of course they're false. The point of that literature is to create fantasy worlds. Someone who read it as history is making a big mistake because, literally speaking, they're all false. Right? Now, that means that I can use my concept of truth, and I can use my concept of rationality, and I can use my concept of justification. I don't have to apologize for the use of those concepts, and they apply directly. And I'll just insert a little footnote here. What are we supposed to imagine? A culture that doesn't have our concept. Doesn't use our concept of truth, doesn't use our concept of rationality, it does something else. So as I said, I can apply mine, they just don't care. They're just not interested in it. I think that's very, very hard to imagine. Let's imagine how these people in this culture function. Person A is looking for his keys and says to B, you know, I can't find my keys, where did I leave them? And he says, well, they're on the table, you know, in the dining room. And A goes into the dining room and looks on the table and the keys aren't there. Does he notice? Gosh, B told me they're on the table and they aren't. Does he go back and ask B next time where his keys are? Does he always go and look where B said? Does it occur to him that something is out of whack here? They're fighting a battle. And A is on the wall and he's shooting arrows at the enemy and he's out of arrows as to B. Hand up some more arrows. And B comes back a moment later with a cup of hot chocolate. Does A notice this? Does it occur to him that he didn't get what he asked for? Does he find any incongruity here? You mean he doesn't have the concept of truth? So how does he get around from one day to the next? He plants black-eyed beans in a certain patch, and all the plants wither, and that winter he starves. Does he plant them in the same patch next year? Does he notice that he was starving? Does he remember that he was starving? Can he think in terms of predicting the same thing? Or he doesn't have our concept of reason, doesn't have our concept of evidence, he operates with something else. With what? The Ouija board? And what is he doing? How does he survive from one week to the next? To imagine a culture that doesn't have the basic common human repertoire of truth and reason and evidence and validity is to imagine a culture that really hasn't got the tools to survive. So I say, number one, if they don't have our concepts, that doesn't stop us from applying our concepts at all. It has nothing to do with it. And number two, it's very hard to imagine a culture that doesn't have our concepts. Now, How about even, well, let me just apply one verbal. So when, as happened to me several times in the past 10 years, when I talk about truth, someone says, oh, you mean Western truth. When they say that to you, what's the correct answer?
Of course.
I mean, of course, and the word Western is extra, because truth is a Western word. So, truth, by definition, is Western truth. That's all the truth there is. And either you have a concept that agrees, in which case you also have truth, or you don't have a concept that agrees. Either way, there's nothing wrong with me applying my concept to your culture and declaring what is true and isn't true. True. T-R-U-E. True. In your culture, whether you care about it or not. It doesn't stop me from applying my concepts. This old idea that the concepts of one culture just don't apply to another culture is a concept which there might be some applications to it, but all the big concepts, all the important concepts to which it's usually with which it's associated, simply don't apply. Now let's take morality. Let's take morality. Right and wrong, just and unjust. Surely we'll be told that Western standards are right and wrong, just and unjust, are just Western standards. It's just the way the West has, Western culture has grown to look at it. But other cultures might see things entirely differently. Well, the first defense is what I've said over and over again. Right and wrong, just and unjust, good and evil are Western concepts. Yes, they are. Quite right. And when I judge anything to be good or evil, I'm judging it in terms of G-O-O-D and E-V-E-I-L. Those are the only concepts I got. They're the only concepts I can use. There's nothing else I can do. And why shouldn't it apply to another culture? Indeed, many very important historical critiques and contemporary critiques are based on this kind of application. Ask a feminist what she thinks about a culture in which women are systematically disadvantaged and even the women don't complain. Even the women don't complain. Why? Because they're trained and indoctrinated to believe that this is the way it is, this is the way it has to be, this is no other way it can be. Or they have some kind of doctrine which teaches them that it's good to be this way. I don't know much about history. When I was younger, less aware of what's important, I found history very boring. I had one teacher of history as an undergraduate who said something very important. Probably the only thing I remember in the studies of history. He was teaching the French Revolution. He said the situation in France for 500 years was enormous suffering. You had the feudal system with feudal lords who owned the serfs. The serfs were their private property. They starved them. They taxed them. They used them in battles. For five centuries, it was awful. Then came the revolution. The question is, why did the revolution come 2 centuries earlier? Or 3 centuries earlier? There wasn't enough power in the king, the nobles, and their bands of soldiers to withstand the whole citizenry. When the revolution came, it didn't take long for them to overthrow. He says, his name is Frank Manuel, he says that the concept of another way of organizing society didn't exist. The background for the French Revolution was philosophical. For the preceding 4 centuries, the feudal system was like the sun coming up in the morning. Now let's suppose it's August, and it's very hot, and you're getting sunburned working, you don't have UFV 15 oil, right? You're a French peasant working out there, and you're getting sunburned, and it's very hot. You don't wish tomorrow the sun wouldn't come up. Because the sun doesn't come up, we're all dead. Okay, it's hot and uncomfortable, that's right, and it's painful. But I want the sun to come up. Because to you, there's nothing else. There's the sun or death. Comes the 17th century, beginning of the 18th century, all of a sudden, a new set of ideas is concocted. And people begin to see that maybe there's another way to organize society which doesn't have to have so much misery. That's what led them to the idea that it would be possible to have an alternative and which enabled them to overthrow the government. Now, someone who says in the preceding 400 years people were suffering unjustly, unfairly, belly. And it was an evil system, even though no one at the time said so, and no one at the time was thinking of an alternative, and no one at the time was thinking of overthrowing it, would be right. The feminists who say that societies in which women are systematically disadvantaged, even if the women are indoctrinated to the point where they don't see it, don't appreciate it, this is what the communists used to call false consciousness. A consciousness based on a false proposition about how the world works. That doesn't mean it isn't evil. So why can't we use Western concepts, which is the only concepts we have, concepts of good and evil, and use them to classify what's going on in other societies? Why can't we? What's to stop us? What is there that's incongruous about it? What is there that's inappropriate about it? Now you say, but you know, they could do the same thing. They could use their concepts to apply to you. That's correct. That's correct. But now, there's a fork. Either their concepts are really like ours. They're really like ours. They're really close to ours, similar to ours, and which could deserve the same word or not. If they aren't like ours, so we're talking about good and evil, and they're talking about efficient, beautiful, fun, something else. They're not talking about good and evil. Good, so we can both be right. They're evil, and we're lacking fun, or something, you know, whatever it is, or ugly. It's okay, we can both be right. So what? Does that detract from my ability to say they're evil? Or no, their concepts are really our close to ours, and we share a lot of content, and there's a lot of overlap between the concepts, so much so that, indeed, the word evil could be used for both concepts because they share so much. If so, then you have a moral debate, a real moral debate, and it may not be clear who's right. But guess what? This has nothing to do with other cultures. We have the very same debates within our own culture. We have all sorts of different parties and all sorts of different philosophies within our own culture as to what's right and what's wrong, what are more important and what's less important, what's just and what's, what isn't just. The tradition starting with the Greeks coming to the present is full of controversy. Now maybe they'll ignite a controversy we haven't thought of. That could very well be. There could be a virtue of discussing concepts across cultures because different people from different backgrounds may see facets of the same concept that others don't see. That may very well happen. And then it could be a real dialogue, but when they raise their point, people on our side will immediately say, oh yes, we didn't think of that. Look, this is supposed to apply here, that's supposed to apply there, that's incongruous. How can we possibly put them together? We'll have a natural context of discussion, we'll have natural understanding, and again, there's no problem that you can't apply a concept from one culture to another culture. The difference between cultures here makes no difference. For me, you're going to have the problem between Cambridge and Brooklyn. Let alone between United States and Samoa. So again, the idea that going from one culture to another culture is going to put a limit on your ability to think, to judge, to evaluate, is simply not correct. Are you with me so far? I hope this gives you a lot of caution about this idea of multiculturalism. Yeah.
I didn't quite understand the last one something you were saying.
Let's see if I can use a simpler example where it'll become clearer. Let me start with a really simple one. Could there be a Nigerian way to play chess? Here's how they do it. They have 12 pawns and a king. And each pawn moves in a circle. And the king jumps over everything, and the third thing he jumps over, he takes. That's their way of playing chess. See, there's the Western way of playing chess, the Nigerian way of playing chess. Does that make any sense? That's dumb! I keep saying that because these things are stated with such seriousness and such passion, and placards go up, and people have demonstrations, and nobody gives a moment to think about what they're saying. That's ridiculous. That's not Nigerian chess. It's a different game. Is that a competitor for what chess really is? Now, let's take justice. So, we have a concept of justice. People should be treated fairly. If you make a distinction between two people, it's got to be based on some morally relevant characteristic. Equal pay for equal work, things like that. Well, in country X, Everything is run by the king. What this king says goes. Now, our friend, the liberal anthropologist, says, well, you see, in their country, the king's will is justice. And in America, justice is something else. There's different standards of justice, different concepts of justice. Baloney. If in their culture, what goes is what the king says, they haven't got a concept of justice. If they're happy with that, if that's something which doesn't cause them any pain or any reason to revolt, if there's no critique of that, then they just lack the concept altogether. By definition, justice can't be automatically the will of one man, just because he said it. So they just don't have the concept. So now, there are two possibilities. When you're dealing with another culture, and we're applying our concept to them, either they have our concept, a concept close enough to ours, to be judged that as the same concept or not. If they don't, then true, we can judge them and they can judge us. But we're judging each other in terms of different concepts. We're making different judgments. And they can all be true. We're judging them in terms of justice, and they're judging us in terms of efficiency. Justice is usually very inefficient. An autocracy, with everything organized and rationally allocated, can be much more efficient than a democracy, and a system that cares about justice. Quite right. So they're talking about efficiency, and we're talking about justice. We're right when we say that society is unjust. They say they're right when they say our society is inefficient. We're both right. Just talking about different subjects. That doesn't stop us from saying they're unjust. Doesn't mean we're somehow making a mistake when we say they're unjust. Or no, they have a concept of justice which is close, pretty close to ours. Now, let's say, I don't know what the situation is today, but with respect to when you give advantages to people because of a past history of disadvantage.
Affirmative action.
Affirmative action, right. Is it in or out nowadays?
It's
in.
In the waiting
to be chapter.
No,
it's in. Okay. So it's in. Now you can imagine another society. You can imagine another society that says a person should be judged on his own merits, on his own strengths and on weaknesses. Nothing else should count. That's fair. The fact that his grandfather had a problem or had an advantage had nothing to do with judging him. Why saddle him with the past? The past has nothing to do with it. Judge each person on the basis of his own abilities. That's fair. So now, those are different standards of justice. But notice, if we came across a culture like that, and they expressed their point of view, they would get a very favorable hearing in a large segment of American opinion. Because there's a large segment of Americans who hold exactly that on the basis of our concept of justice. Here, our concept of justice is not that clear. Our concept of justice has problems. Many deep concepts have problems. Controversial areas where they aren't clear. So here, that culture is going to come down on one side of the concept, and our culture may come down on a different side of the concept. If the reasoning and the application and the tension between the two of them is appreciated by both sides, we'll be able to say, yes, they are the same concept, and yes, there's a disagreement here within the concept. But this disagreement doesn't need another culture to stimulate it. Because between Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Biloxi, Mississippi, you'll have the same difference of opinion within American culture. So nothing in the fact that it's culture A facing culture B plays any role in the debate. That's just irrelevant. It has nothing to do with it. Now, I want to make one final remark. Okay, maybe we can apply our standards of right and wrong. But what is there to justify? What is there to justify our standards of right and wrong as appropriate, valid in some sense? Aren't they all just made up? Isn't it just how we happen to do things? Could there be any objective standard of good and evil, right and wrong, justice and injustice? The truth is, in what I've already told you, there's an answer to this question. It just has to be focused in the right way. Let's think about disagreement. How far can disagreement go? What kinds of disagreements are reasonable or even understandable? I say that Rembrandt is a greater painter than Van Gogh. No, Van Gogh is a better painter than Rembrandt. Good. We can understand a disagreement about that. I say, I think there are 6.3 billion Chinese. And you say, no, there's 6.4 billion Chinese. Good. We could disagree about that. In fact, going to the encyclopedia probably is not a good way to do it, because how does the encyclopedia know? Because the Chinese did a census? Ah, give me another joke. So these things you could imagine disagreement about. You could imagine trying to settle it, like going out and doing things to discover who's right. Now suppose somebody says, there are no tables. There are no tables. I know, you believe there are tables. You have a theory that there are tables. You have a hypothesis that there are tables. You believe in that. I don't. See, people are different. People have different view on the world, and different ideas, and different judgments. You believe in tables, and I don't believe in tables. That's it. We just disagree about that. How does that sound? I know you were taught arithmetic in second grade, and being soft, jelly-headed, non-critical person, you accepted that 2 plus 2 is 4. But I didn't. I was very independent, very critical, very tough-minded. And I believe that 2 plus 2 is 5. We disagree about this. Your theory is 2 plus 2 is 4. My theory is 2 plus 2 is 5. You believe 2 plus 2. I don't believe in that. I believe 2 plus 2 is 5. See, we just disagree. Does this sound a little odd? A little peculiar? What's going wrong? Why is it that we can disagree about the population of China? And we can disagree about Rembrandt and Van Gogh? But somehow the disagreement about whether there are tables or not just doesn't fit in the same group. It doesn't sound the same. It doesn't feel the same. Disagreement about whether 2 plus 2 is 5 or 2 plus 2 is 4 just doesn't fit the same barrel. The reason is roughly this. A person says something. He's talking. He's talking to me. I have to assume that we both know what talking is, and we both have a purpose in talking, and that talking is carried out by certain conventions, certain rules, certain natural ways of doing things. If I don't know that, then how am I to distinguish him from somebody playing the saxophone? You know, sounds are coming out of his mouth, so what? I know the sounds are, there are no tables. But maybe it's just, you know, Yankee Doodle and saxophone. And he's saying this. Well, if he's saying it to me, we're both human beings, we're inhabiting the same world, I have to assume that when he looks around this room, he sees the same thing that I do. And when he puts his elbows over here, he's supported by the same thing I'm supported. How could he possibly say that there are no tables? How could he say that? So, there are a couple of possibilities. Either he's not serious. It's a joke. One subclass of being not serious and being a joke is he's a philosopher. He's nuts. He's just nuts. Not in control of himself. Or, by T-A-B-L-E, he doesn't mean what I mean. We have different concepts here. For me and you, and I suppose everybody in the room, table is this sort of thing. For him, table, by definition, is made out of your radioactive carbon. I don't think we're all getting radioactive poisoning sitting here, you know, with radioactive carbon. Or table, for him, by definition, means made of gold, or ice, or owned by the Queen of France, or I don't know, some other weird concept. Maybe he means something different from what I mean. These are ways of making sense out of it. He's a human being. Looks like me, I suppose. Or if you prick us, shall we not bleed? Said Shylock and Shakespeare, Merchant of Venice. Why, you know, so he looks like us. Now, we know what talking is. We know what looking is. We know what evidence is. We know how people come to understand things about the world. He seems to look like us. He seems to have had relevant experiences, like sitting in the room and looking and feeling these things in front of us. And he says, there are no tables. I don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do. If he's saying, if he's not joking, and he has the same concepts as we do, then he's nuts. He can't be saying. You can't say that under these conditions. There are certain disagreements that can't be accepted as disagreements. You can't just disagree about something like that. Now, one subtle remark. I know it's 9:23, and I know you're tired, and I know this has been a lot of material, but this is crucial to get. I'm not saying that we have to be right. I'm not saying we have to be right. I'm just saying that a person who boldly says there are no tables is someone who's put himself beyond the realm of understanding. I don't know what's going on in him. I don't know how to deal with him. He's not relevant to my reality if he says something like that. But he could make himself relevant. He could do it. Just saying there are no tables isn't enough. But he could do something. Here's what he could do. He could say, I was hiking in the Andes, and I came across a landing site of a spaceship. And this space is very advanced design. It operates by some kind of mechanism that we don't know. And I found records of a session where they took over the media of the world, and they planted in world media post-hypnotic suggestions that there are tables. So I'm telling you, we're all suffering from this hypnotism, that there are tables. There really are tables. They just hypnotize us to think we see and feel tables. If he did that, maybe we would have to think again. Indeed, maybe we would have to think again. So, when I say I can't make sense out of the guy who just says there are no tables, I don't mean we're right that there are tables. I'm not saying that. We might be wrong, but he can't just say there are no tables. Why? Because to common experience, it's obvious that there are tables. What he has to do is two things. He has to explain why. Even though it's obvious to everyone that there are tables, he has to explain how it could be wrong. And then he has to give us some reason to think it's wrong. He has to take a two-step process. Now, that's a crazy example, right? About tables and Martians landing on the Andes. But let me give you real examples from real history. There was a time when it was obvious to everyone that the Earth is stationary. The Earth is not moving. You know, the Earth is moving. Give me a break. I'm sitting on it. I can tell if it's moving or not. You ever sit the train that was moving? You know it was moving, right? Well, sitting on the Earth, it's not moving. You can just see it's not moving. More than that, I'll do an experiment, a scientific experiment. We'll climb up a tall tower. Tall, straight tower with straight vertical sides. Lean out the tower and drop a stone. Now, if the Earth is moving, while the stone is falling, the Earth is moving out from under it. So the stone ought to fall some distance away from the tower. Or if the Earth is moving the other way, then the stone ought to bang into the wall of the tower on the way down. Try it! You're a scientist, right? You're a reasonable person. Climb the tower and try. Well, they did it! They actually did it, and guess what? It falls right next to the tower every time. So it's not moving. It's obvious it's not moving. Now, someone would come up and say, at that time, the following. I know. Your theory is it's not moving. That's your theory. That's your belief. That's your hypothesis. That's your guess. Well, I say it is moving. I disagree. You say it is moving. I say it is moving. That's all there is to it. You know, we just disagree. He'd be just as nuts as someone who says that there are no tables. Because he's contradicting the obvious, universal, common experience of all mankind for no reason. That's not reasonable. It's not reasonable to oppose the common, universal experience of all mankind for no reason. But now, suppose he says, listen, fellas, I have to tell you a story. No, it's not just that I disagree. I have a reason to disagree. Here's my reason. First of all, you say you don't feel it moving? That's because you're moving with it. If you shut your eyes and